we find that these pieces of wisdom are very much applicable to today's time. And we also see that in the universal persona of Imam Ali, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he was able to, just as all divinely appointed leaders, very concisely and in a very short and sweet manner convey very deep and profound concepts and meanings. In one place, Imam Ali alayhi salam, he said that life is divided into 2 days, or better to say, 2 parts. One day, the world turns towards man, and on another day, the world turns its back on him. Therefore, be careful not to be arrogant when the world turns towards you, and remember to be patient when the world turns its back on you. And dear friends, is this truly not what life comes down to? On one day, the world is in our favor, the cards are in our favor, the chips are up, and everything is in our favor, everything is good. We have what we need. Actually, we have more than what we need. And on another day, the world turns its back on us. Ooh, the chips are down. The cards are not in our favor. The circumstances and the conditions of our life seem to be negative. They seem to be down. We seem to be on the losing end. And it is interesting, but here Imam Ali is saying that, listen, there's 2 days, don't worry. If the chips are down and the things are not in your favor today, remember that there will be a day when the things are in your favor. And likewise, when things are in your favor, when the world turns towards you, remember that such a day will come when the chips are down and the world is not in your favor. And furthermore, on that day when the world is in your favor, do not become arrogant, do not become haughty, do not become proud, do not commit sin. And on the other hand, when the world turns its back on you, and when the world is not in your favor, again, do not commit sin, and be patient. A beautiful, profound lesson from the universal persona of alayhi salam. كل صبح وكل اشراب ايام تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبني فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
So whenever we hear the fadail of Imam Ali alayhi salam, we must always put the Prophet as not included amongst the people being talked about. This is an automatic rule that we were taught when we were studying. They never include the Prophet in this. When the Imam Ali alayhi salam says, I'm the best at this, except for the Prophet, because he is a servant of the Prophet. So this is an important rule to understand. Now, we come back to the same thing, and I always, as one who prepares lectures, comes up, I face the same difficulties, and that is, how do we begin to describe this great personality or talk about him? And I want to look at it for his life from his power of attraction and his power of repulsion. Yeah? What I mean by that? I mean that Imam Ali alayhi salam has that characteristic where he has the power to attract people towards him, and at the same time, he has the power to repel people away from him. Yes? That means he has this ability to make people love him and hate him at the same time. This is an art, my brothers and sisters. How you can be loved so much and how you can be hated so much. Imam Ali alayhi salam teaches us how to do this. And when we look at history, there is no other personality like Imam Ali alayhi salam who is loved as much and hated as much by people. Since the beginning, there were those who would give their lives for Ali ibn Abi Talib, while there were those who couldn't wait to kill Ali ibn Abi Talib. And that carries on till today. There are people like us that when the name of Ali is said, our hearts begin to beat faster. And there are people who the name of Ali is mentioned, they can't wait to curse Ali ibn Abi Talib. This is till today. We were in Sham, and one of my friends there tells me that, and you know, in Sayyidah Zainab, there's no secret that there's as many, or if not more Sunnah than there are Shia who gather in Sayyidah Zainab alayhi salam and who live there. So one day they were having the wiladat of Imam Ali alayhi salam and they had sweets laid out. And a Sunni man walked by, and again, these are not all Sunnis who are like this, but those who have that Wahhabi mentality have this automatic bughd, hatred in their hearts for Imam Ali alayhi salam. So he grabbed a candy and he said, Shunul Munasibat, what is the Munasibat for today? And he says, Wiladat of Amir al-Mu'mineen. He threw that candy like it was dirty. He said, I don't want this candy. Yeah? Why? Because he had the hatred of Imam Ali alayhi salam in his heart. And this is no secret.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolimi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the prime minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the prime minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's been driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
This is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as Prime Minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms, because we are under occupation. Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic, and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran is Sagheer, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching the Iran revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry, paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
People of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyid Safid, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranians celebrate the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution that transformed the country from a U.S. ally to a bitter opponent. Yemenis are still facing a deadly U.S.-backed war. This has urged Yemeni politicians to try to learn more about the Islamic Revolution and its stance against U.S. hegemony.
The region was about to fall prey to the American Zionist project, and the Arab regimes would have given up on the Palestinian cause, resulting in the further oppression of the Palestinians and the deterioration of the Arabs' dream of liberation from American hegemony. The Islamic Revolution turned Iran into the first country to be freed from U.S. dependence. It created a psychological balance among the people. As for the Arab puppet regimes, they feared the danger of the people and delayed their normalization with the Zionists. Today, Muslims are aware of U.S. dominating policies and find liberation necessary.
Yemeni politicians and scholars say the Islamic Revolution keeps on inspiring Yemeni people to stand against the U.S. and its supported forces in the region, just as they did on their September 21st revolution 8 years ago.
I still remember the outbreak of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I was studying in secondary school and Arab people were constantly talking about it. We even wore t-shirts with the image of Imam Khomeini. But given the importance of this revolution, many Arab dictators started to ban the clothes that had the image of Imam Khomeini on them. And this is one of the first memories that they have of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni people have learned a lot from the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It encouraged them to stand against the colonial policies in their own country. And this also sparked their revolution of September 21st, 2014.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has always been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and has marked the International Quds Day. And now it is also standing beside the people of Yemen and the US-backed Saudi leader against them.
Observers say all the free people of the world must look up to the Islamic Revolution of Iran and follow in the footsteps of its leaders in order to stand against the U.S. hegemony. They say the Islamic Revolution will remain a source of pride for all Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities. Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel on a Qandil occupied Ramallah.
U.S. police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic. It's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are 3 times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to healthcare, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed, Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE, and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it, and others more over, like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate. Because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status of the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtayyeh, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer's status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale, and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable. It's possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and old alike, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Benjamin Abdullahi, Abuja.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians, because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue, or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat Obad 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Attorney George Conway has suggested that former President Donald Trump is afraid of what former Vice President Mike Pence could say. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Jason Lemon. The piece is titled, Trump Fears What Pence Could Say, suggests Conway, surprisingly weak. Attorney George Conway has suggested that former President Donald Trump is afraid of what former Vice President Mike Pence could say. Donald Trump on Friday evening, 4th of February, released a statement taking aim at Mike Pence after the former Vice President explained that Trump was wrong to claim that he had the authority to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. The ex-president argued this week that Mike Pence should have unconstitutionally rejected the electors from key swing states in a bid to keep him in the White House. George Conway, the husband of Donald Trump's former senior counselor Kellyanne Conway, has long been critical of his wife's ex-boss. In a Saturday Twitter post, George Conway shared Donald Trump's statement targeting Mike Pence and suggested the former president is weak. Surprisingly weak. You suppose that Trump is afraid of something that Pence could say, Conway wrote. In his Friday evening statement, Donald Trump said, just saw Mike Pence's statement on the fact that he had no right to do anything with respect to the electoral vote count. The former president went on to insist that I was right and everyone knows it. Earlier on Friday, 4th of February, Mike Pence told attendees at a conservative Federalist Society event in Florida that he fundamentally disagreed with Donald Trump regarding the vice president's power over the election results. But there are those in our party who believe that as the presiding officer over the joint session of Congress, I possess unilateral authority to reject electoral college votes. And I heard this week, President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election, the former vice president told the audience in Florida. Mike Pence added, President Trump is wrong, adding that he had no right to overturn the election. Mike Pence's remarks came after Trump earlier in the week suggested Pence should be investigated for refusing to unconstitutionally overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election. Although George Conway's wife, Kellyanne Conway, was one of Donald Trump's key advisors and top defender in the media, he constantly stamped the former president throughout his White House tenure. Speaking to CNN on Monday, George Conway responded to Donald Trump's suggestion that Mike Pence could have overturned the election. "He is just incriminating himself with all of these statements," the conservative lawyer said. George Conway added, "This is just absurd. He's just not smart." Meanwhile, Trump's allies have lined up to attack Mike Pence. If you ever had any doubt whatsoever that former Vice President Mike Pence was duplicitous and disloyal, this stunning article will remove any doubt. Mike Pence and his staff of political advisors were working to undermine President Trump and replace him with Mike Pence from day one, right-wing strategist Roger Stone wrote in a message to his Telegram subscribers on Thursday. Roger Stone linked to a Substack article written by Emerald Robinson titled "The Treachery of Vice President Mike Pence Explained." Steve Bannon, who served as chief executive officer of Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, called Mike Pence a coward in a segment of his War Room podcast on Friday. "Pence, you're going to carry this thing eventually to your grave, okay?" Steve Bannon said. He added, "Because it is a mark of shame, you're a stone-cold coward." Newsweek has reached out to both Mike Pence and Donald Trump for comment, but did not immediately receive any responses.
He has a famous sentence saying that our controversy is pointless, meaning what? If all of us are following religions of Allah, we should not disagree each other.
So this library is one of the most notable and important activities of Mr. Falotui.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in The Teacher.
What will we say in front of them?
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRabi English Radio. This is The Teacher. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Sheikh Ziyania. Sheikh Ziyania, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
As you know, the program, The Teacher, is about the life and works of the most outstanding Muslim scholars, thinkers, philosophers, jurists all across the nation of Islam. And for today's discussion, we want to talk about an outstanding Persian Shiite philosopher, a Muslim, Shiite philosopher by the name of Abdul Jawad Falaturi, who dedicated his life, in fact, into spreading the Islamic philosophy, Islamic hikmah, in Germany, and he's famous for his services to Shia Islam over there. Okay, Abdul Jawad Falaturi, Sheikh Ziyania, give us some information about his early life.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Dr. Abdul Jawad Falaturi was born in 1304 in solar calendar in Isfahan, famous city in Iran. He was born in a religious family. He graduated from a German-Iranian school in Isfahan and then moved into Mashhad to study Islamic studies beside the holy shrine of Imam Rida alayhi salam. And because he was interested in philosophy, he took his major, his main major in Islamic studies as the philosophy. Mm-hmm. And in a way that even he was nursing one of his teachers, I mean Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani rahmatullah alayhi. After studying philosophy with some great scholars like Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani, that he gave, Mirza Mehdi gave him a permission, a written permission, that is giving very, privilege and, high-ranking, titles to Marhum Falaturi. Then he moved into Tehran and studied in the University of Tehran for 3 years and got his bachelor in philosophy. And after that, he moves to Germany to continue his studies and researches in philosophy especially.
Okay, that's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Zeynia. For sure, the school that he attended when young, when a teen, I mean the Iranian German school, had role in learning the language Germany, okay, and then moving to the country Germany over there. So he moves to Germany and continues his studies, also his teachings over there. What is his main method of teaching over there?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Actually, when he graduated from Köln University, so he got or obtained this position in the university as the professor. So when you are obtaining this position, you will be busy teaching in this university, another university, being engaged with your students. And all these activities are included under the topic of scientific activities. Yes. But we have to keep in mind that Professor Abdul Jawad Falaturi, besides being a philosopher, he had this concern for preaching and spreading Islam as a religion. That's why we see that one of the great Shia library founded in the Europe is entitled under his name.
Okay.
So besides being a professor, he was really active in the field of tabligh and preaching and spreading Islam. And at that time, because of facing Islamophobia and people were not familiar with Islam, and they had misunderstanding and misjudgment about Islam. Yes. One of the main concern for him to remove these misunderstanding among native people of Germany was to establish a movement in order to change the textbook of the youth, specifically students of the schools.
Yes.
I mean, before they get into the university.
Okay.
Because he was aware of this point, that wrong information will mislead people.
Okay.
So definitely, as a general subject or general topics, in the high school or in the elementary school, student will get to know about different religions all around the world.
That's
and
right.
Islam is one of those religions.
Okay.
So he was aware of those information being placed in their books, I mean in their textbooks. So one of his main concern was to change the textbook of a foreign country. You see how ambitious he is.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes even in our country, when we see something is going wrong in our textbook for our children, we are not ambitious enough to take such a risk to start having a group of people starting on working on a proper textbook for our children.
Yes.
But he, as a professor, as a dignified person, being engaged in scientific activities, he had this concern that since they do not being fed by good information about Islam, they are going to grow up on those bad or wrong information, and they will be misled.
And was it only on religious studies or all the books? You know, I mean, in
mainly on the, not the religious, as I said, religion is one of the topics that students will go through that.
Yes.
To get to know about the religions all around the world, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. So his main concern was to change the textbook of the children of a country far from Iran. So he was really ambitious.
That's all right.
May God bless him.
God bless him. And maybe sometimes we have to correct the understanding of some of the people about the basic beliefs of a religion like Islam, especially the Shiite Islam. Because we know that so many books that are available in the Western countries are based on the Orientalist findings, most of which might be a wrong portrayal of the beliefs of the Muslims or Muslim lands. It's better for the Westerners or the Western academies in order to learn it from the people who are specialized in this field, I mean the Muslims themselves. And the case of language over here is also important. I mean, somebody like Abdul-Jawad Faraturi had mastered over German language, so he could renew this type of idea. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the foundation of a library over there, which is really important for an Iranian, you know, to found a library about Shia Islam in Germany, which is very famous nowadays,
yeah.
The place of the visit to so many people, scholars and researchers all across Europe. What is this library exactly?
When he was living in Germany, he felt this necessity that the resources of Shia school of thought must be transferred into Western culture and Western, you know, research atmosphere. So he himself decided to establish a specific library that is dedicated for Shia school of thought. And as you mentioned, this library is still active in mm-hmm. Germany.
Yes.
So the story is interesting because he wanted to transfer these books from Iran to
yes.
Germany. There is a long way.
More than 4,000 volumes, they say.
Yes.
It's difficult. Okay.
So he loaded these books on the truck.
Oh.
And, you know, they moved all these way by a truck.
Okay.
And they placed the books in the library in Germany.
So it was a road journey.
Yeah.
The books from Iran over there. Okay.
So, and most of his works were not done by, you know, we may say governmental aids.
Mm-hmm.
No, he was
yeah.
using some aids by, you know, donations or help of some of his friends or by his, you know,
yes.
own efforts. So this library is one of the most notable and important activities of Mr. Falaturi. Another important point about Marhum Falaturi is that he was amongst the members of the High Council of Islamic Affairs of Al-Azhar University in Egypt.
Okay.
And it's also very important that a Shia scholar living in Germany is acting in a way that Al-Azhar is inviting him to be a member of that High Council. This is very important.
That's all right.
So Mr. Falaturi was not only, you know, dedicating and specializing his activities in university.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes scholars are only, you know, we may say, are unifying their activities in a single way.
Yes.
Mr. Falaturi was trying to broadcast
yes.
the message of Ahlul Bayt
yes.
in
okay.
every different means that
yes.
he could. Establishing library,
yes.
correcting the books,
mm-hmm.
talking with people,
yes.
having dialogue with them
yes.
in the academy that
yes.
he established.
Okay.
So he was active in
yes.
every field that he was feeling the necessity of being active.
I think Falaturian belonged to a generation of the people who believed, we can say, completely in the religion of Islam, Shia Islam and religion beliefs, by trying to spend their time and, we can say, efforts at the university and the academic level. We have this beautiful generation of the people among the scholars of Iran. So many great names are over there. Dr. Jafar Shahidi was one of them. Dr. Gorji, another one, was one of them who got permission of ijtihad from outstanding ulama of Najaf.
Even Dr. Jafari Langerudin.
Yes. And so many other people, you know, who were not clergymen at the first look, but they spent, we can say, their life on theology, Islamic beliefs, and so on, especially in the European countries. Okay, anything missed, Sheikh Mahtavi?
I think this is good to know that obtaining such position in university enabled him to co-author many
mm-hmm.
works
very good.
With the great scholars of the Western universities, specifically GMA universities, namely Monika Truschka, Herbert Schultz, Braun Schweig, Moritz Desterk, Hans Wecking, and Hans Zirker, and other
yes.
scholars.
Yes.
So we have to take this into consideration. When we look at the topics of his works, it has something to do with Islam,
mm-hmm.
establishing dialogue
yes.
in Islam. So it shows that, as you, to your brother, mentioned, having this open-minded understanding of Islam,
mm-hmm.
trying to sit around one table with the representatives of other religions,
okay.
understanding them, extending this borders,
yes.
I mean the religious borders. He has a famous sentence saying that our controversy and disagreement,
mm-hmm.
meaning that including
the followers of Abrahamic religion.
Yes.
He is saying that our controversy is pointless and meaningless to okay. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm-hmm. Meaning what? If all of us are following religions of Allah or the Abrahamic religion, we should not fight with each other. That's we should not disagree each other, although there are differences, what we have to sit around one table. And these activities and this open-mindedness enabled him to get this position in Germany, as I said, to be given this chance to have some modification on the textbooks.
That's all right.
Yeah, this is very important. Okay. And also we have to keep in mind, besides all these activities, I mean, including the academic activities, being engaged in philosophy, he was really giving the most important focus on Quran.
Mm-hmm.
He has also another famous sentence saying that throughout spreading and preaching Islam in Germany,
mm-hmm.
the only thing I was referring to and I was referring people to was Quran.
Okay.
So actually he was really upset about our distance with Quran, saying that why we are that far from Quran and the noble teachings of Quran. These noble teaching will draw people on the right path of Allah.
Okay.
So this is also interesting.
And that's why even when he was invited by the University of Mashhad and the University of Tehran to teach philosophy in there, he said, if I come to Iran again to teach, I will teach Quran and Nahjul Balagha, nothing else.
Very good. That's all right. So many books have been written by him in both German language and the English language, you know. Most of them focus on the religion of Islam. He was really a source of benefit for so many Western scholars and researchers who want to be familiar with Islamic philosophy, Islamic theology, and Islamic aqaid and beliefs. He was over there in Germany, in Köln, and then in Hamburg, you know, with founding the library. And maybe so many of the books that are available in the libraries of the Shiite world are not used by the people of those Muslim land themselves. You know, this is the good story about those people who are interested in a dedication. I mean, dedication of the book from a Muslim land to a non-Muslim land can be the source of khairat, barakat, and blessings, you know, for them very much. This is a good action, and I think Fala Turi was really great in this world. It was a winter at the age of 71 in 1337, according to the solar calendar. He passed away in Germany. His body was taken into the city of Isfahan, the city that he was born, and he was buried in a grave by the tomb of Haji Aga Rahim Arbab, another great outstanding mystic Islamic philosopher, in the city of Isfahan. May Allah bless his soul. And thank you very much, Sheikh Mahtavi and Sheikh Ziyainia.
You're most welcome.
For being present in the program, the teacher talking about Abdul Jawad Falaturi, the outstanding Muslim Shiite philosopher in Germany. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode and introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.